Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, election day in this country. And before we start talking about the 9th annual Widening the Circle Native American and Hmong Indigenous Education Symposium, I want to remind you of a couple things. One is, if you have not yet voted and you want some more information, we have a very thorough web place for you to go, and it's Wisconsin Vote, where you will find candidate biographies, interviews. If you have some confusion about your polling place, you can go there, voter registration information, the latest election news, and you can watch results tonight on wisconsinvote.org is the place to go. And here on the radio, we start our coverage tonight at 6 o'clock with an hour-long national call-in program. At 7 o'clock, an NPR special hosted by Robert Siegel and Melissa Block, with all of the NPR reporters who've been covering this race, these races, I should say, for a long, long time. At 8 o'clock, a full evening of election coverage from Wisconsin Public Radio News and National Public Radio News, including coverage of state and national races hosted by Sean Johnson from WPR and Frederica Freiberg from Wisconsin Public Television. You will hear from Wisconsin Public Radio reporters, political analysts, and candidates throughout the broadcast. Election coverage begins at 6 o'clock. At 7, programs will be carried on all Wisconsin Public Radio broadcast stations and streams. November 8th through November 11, La Crosse is hosting a very interesting symposium. It's the 9th annual Widening the Circle Native American and Hmong Indigenous Education Symposium, and it addresses education in both the Native and Hmong cultures in the state of Wisconsin. This hour, we're going to be talking about the mission of the event, what students and educators will explore, and why it is important for everybody living in this state to know about Native American and Hmong culture, and why legislators many years ago decided that we needed to learn about this in our schools. We have two guests with us. Matthew Stewart is chair of the Widening the Circle Symposium. Matthew, thanks very much for being with us this morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yeah. And also joining us is Song Seong, executive director for the La Crosse Area Hmong Mutual Assistance Association. Song Seong, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Let's talk about the history of this, Matthew, and start with you. This goes way back when there was a great deal of tension between Native groups in Wisconsin and people in other parts of Wisconsin who didn't understand Native history, didn't it?
It does, actually, yes. I get a chance to talk about this often, and I don't know if I can do it in a... in a short time. It's a very exciting story, actually. First of all, let me say thank you for having us on.
Yes, our pleasure.
It's wonderful to be on here with you. And if I think for the listeners, it's important to have an understanding of the background with regards to this. When we look at history in Wisconsin, and not just Native history, but the history of the state of Wisconsin, we really are looking at a number of different attempts by non-Native people to move into the state, and that was done in different ways based on where people were in the state. But in northern Wisconsin, largely what had happened was that a number of treaties were signed,
yes,
with the Ojibwe bands, right? And that those treaties guaranteed and were and had certain rights reserved by the Ojibwe bands, so that these were not rights that were provided by the U.S. government or given to Native people, but that these were rights that were reserved by the Ojibwe leaders. And when those treaties were signed, they maintained what are called usufructuary rights, or user's rights to the land. And among those were rights to hunt, to fish, to gather off of lands in those ceded territories, off of lands that were sold to the United States government. The state of Wisconsin, when it was incorporated, essentially ignored those treaty rights for 150 years, and actually persecuted individuals, Ojibwe individuals, who would go off the reservation to exercise those rights. And a lot of people knew about those and talked about them, and yet and continued to do those, and would still be would still get in trouble from the state of Wisconsin, and the state would intimidate people, would come and confiscate boats or vehicles, would confiscate hunting and spearfishing equipment. I know that you've done a number of different programs over the years on spearfishing, but probably the best part of the story is in the 1970s, a couple of brothers from the Coudray Reservation were up at I believe St. Scholastica in Duluth, and taking a class on treaty rights and tribal policy. And at those, and within in their class, they were really learning about what those usufructuary rights really were, and really how the treaties were worded so that those rights were maintained. And as they learned more and more about that, they realized that, oh, these rights were never given up. In fact, we continue to have the right to be able to hunt and fish and gather off of the reservation in ceded territories. And so they talked to a number of people, did some organizing, and went and set up a test case, and actually went off the reservation during spearfishing season and went spearing. Of course, they were arrested, and the case was eventually heard in a district court. And it was the Tribble Brothers, or I'm sorry, LCO, against the state of Wisconsin, and the state of Wisconsin lost. And it the U.S. District Court upheld the right to hunt, fish, and gather off of the reservation in ceded territories for the Ojibwe band members. And of course, what happened after that was that there was a number of people who went spearfishing off the reservation, and in parts of northern Wisconsin, in a lot of parts of northern Wisconsin, the response by non-Native folks was extreme, to say the least.
Yes.
And there was a lot of not just racial tension, but a lot of racial violence that was going on. A lot of people were, you know, beaten up. There was, people that were attacked. There was people whose vehicles and homes were vandalized. And at each one of the sites where Ojibwe band members were going to go spearfishing, non-Native folks would hold large protests, often violent and extremely racist and hate-filled. And yet the spearfishers continued to do that. They went out, they began organizing and elicited support from people across the state, really across the country, and numbers of other people would come, often non-Native people, other Native people would come and physically put themselves between the spears and the protesters, the anti-Indian protesters, which would make it easier for the spears to go out on the lakes.
And as a result of all of this tension, there was legislation passed, and I'm wondering if it's still in existence, that requires studying of Wisconsin Indian history, culture, and tribal sovereignty in public schools?
Yes, there was. Thank you. And I appreciate you moving me along with this, because this can be an amazing and great story. And there really was. What happened was, what we refer to as Act 31 was passed. Act 31 is actually the American Indian State Statutes. The American Indian Studies State Statutes. And what it says is that within the state of Wisconsin, teachers are mandated to teach about Wisconsin Native sovereignty, history, and treaty rights, and preferably at least in the three grade levels. And usually that's taken as, given the curriculum across most of the state, fourth grade, eighth grade, and 10th grades.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, Kathleen, that we often wonder if if it's still in existence as well. No, and that's a joke, because there is no enforcement piece to Act 31. And so oftentimes what happens is that teachers don't get proper training in it as they're going through to become teachers. And so they get out into the classroom and they don't know how to teach for it. Many teachers know that there's this law out there that they're supposed to fulfill in some way, but don't really know how to meet it, and often end up doing things that to try to meet it that are probably worse.
Mm-hmm. And Song Seong, let me talk to you for a moment, executive director for the La Crosse area Hmong Mutual Assistance Association. Does that now also include the Hmong population in the state of Wisconsin, Act 31, or not?
No, it doesn't.
Should it?
I know that there were several attempts on our communities to get an act like Act 31 in place to learn about Hmong culture, history, and why the Hmong people are here in Wisconsin. But I know that it's failed numerous times.
And how recently was the last attempt? Is this something that you've been doing for years now?
Yeah, I believe it was in 2000 and... don't quote me on that. I think it's 2009 or something like that was the last attempt mm-hmm. at getting it passed through the legislature.
Yeah. I'm amazed. A lot of people really don't know the history of why the Hmong are in Wisconsin, and it's a very rich history and history that we should know about, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's our kids don't even know our histories because they're not being taught about it, either in the schools or at home, because it's such a traumatic thing for our people. And so when they go to schools and they're not being taught about it, they don't have a sense of, like, who they are. They know that they're not part of the mainstream culture, but they don't know what it means to be Hmong or how did their parents arrive in this country. And it still shocks me that, you know, middle school kids and elementary school kids don't know, like, where they come from.
And people who are not Hmong don't know why the Hmong are here.
Yes. And I say that would largely due to because there's nothing that are being taught in our schools about Hmong culture, Hmong history, and why we're here.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, can you talk about this conference in terms of bringing together Native American and Hmong people, the Indigenous Education Symposium? Why are these the groups that are included? And do you have a mission? Do you have something you would like to accomplish at the end of this symposium?
Yeah, thank you. Excellent question. The symposium really began. A number of students at UW-La Crosse were, including Song and myself, were began talking a lot about culture and spirituality and ideas of around race and et cetera. And students from the Native American Student Association and the Hmong Student Association, as well as a number of other students who were just involved, really began to see a lot of similarities between Native folks here and Hmong folks in terms of spirituality and the resultant perspectives on the world, on culture and a lot of taboos, why people do the things that they do. And that resulted in a number of different conversations and people really becoming close. And eventually what developed out of that was an attempt to bring in elders from those communities to UW-La Crosse to have a conversation about how do we promote and maintain identity and culture while going to college and what really can be done. And those elders pretty much unanimously agreed that one of the things that should be done here by students who have the resources of the university is to really start teaching or helping those teachers, especially those pre-service teachers, know and understand what they're supposed to be teaching in the classroom. And so after that initial conversation, we developed the first Act 31 Teacher Education Symposium, and that grew over time to from just a one-day kind of conference to really start to include our theoretical base, which we've always used critical multicultural education and especially critical race theory. And we've moved to include other communities with regards to that. And so what we found was that given the similarities in spiritual belief, the similarity in culture in so many ways. And that's not to say that all Native people have the same culture either. But what we're finding is that indigenous people around the world share a lot of things, not just based on being indigenous people, not just based on being tribal people, but there's a lot of what's at the core of a being or what's at the core of your perspective that's shared between whether it's Native people from North America or the Maori from New Zealand, the Native Hawaiians, the Aboriginal people in Australia, uh-huh. to indigenous people in Asia like the Hmong, that there's something that's shared there. And a lot of that goes back to traditional belief systems. Mm. Now that confronts our American schooling system, and we find that there's a lot of conflict right there. And we noticed right away that there was huge conflict in the Hmong community with schooling and with the process of assimilation that schooling so often offers and really is about, and maintaining Hmong identity and culture, and really student self identity and student self self-esteem. And after a number of years of research into it, we really began to recognize that, and this is really what all the findings out there say, is that especially for indigenous students, that school success, however you want to define that, is very, very closely linked with self-identity and with the ability to the school, or with the ability of the school to have students feel like they're included. And I don't mean included in a superficial sense. Often our schools are well known for for example, one of the things that we talk about often is they'll bring out the dancing girls, the Hmong dancing girls. So there'll be an event at a school, and they'll bring out the Hmong dancing girls as though somehow they're involved in the community because they do that. But the curriculum, the culture of the school is still reflected as a very white culture and a very white curriculum. And so what really needs to happen, and what we're really trying to advocate for at Widening the Circle, is both to be a place for Native and Hmong folks to come together to really discuss what is indigenous education, this education that's based on that shared indigenous perspective by indigenous people around the world, and how do we discuss that, and how do we build a better education system mm-hmm. Within our schools, but also to challenge current teachers to begin to think about their practice as one that is culturally laden and very biased, and oftentimes really based on teachers' own privilege and the lack of challenge that they've had in teacher education programs across the state.
So let me ask you about education. I last year spoke at a school that was mm-hmm. entirely Hmong here in Milwaukee, and mm-hmm. it was really extraordinary, first of all, to see the way everybody was moving through the hallways, and nobody, it was just so, everybody was so kind and interested in education, but I didn't really know that there were schools that were all Hmong now. What do you think of that model for education? Are we at a time where regular schools don't understand or don't incorporate Hmong tradition, or don't understand, don't pay attention to Hmong history, so that these kinds of schools that are separate are good, or is that not a model?
I haven't looked at the school in Milwaukee, but I've been to the Twin Cities a lot, where there's a large population of Hmong people, and I've actually gone to the middle and the elementary and the high schools, just looking at those schools that were just designed for Hmong students, and I would say that they're actually in, those students are actually in a worse position than those than the public schools, because they're in an isolated environment in which Hmong culture or Hmong language is taught in the basement of the school and is not infused into the curriculum and is not being taught. And it's, so in other words, they're already marginalized, and then they're going to a school in which they're further marginalized by saying, you know, you're not like the other kids, and your language and culture is being taught in the basement, which means it's really not that important, but this is a school for you guys. And so in some ways, I think it's actually worse, because, you know, the whole agenda of education is still standardization and how do we teach our kids to pass tests, mm-hmm. and not really about can our kids critically think about things. Can they critique things? Mm. Can they understand the materials that are being taught to them, and can they apply it to their life?
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. November 8th through the 11th, La Crosse hosting the 9th annual Widening the Circle Native American and Hmong Indigenous Education Symposium. It's looking at education in both the Native and Hmong cultures in the state of Wisconsin and the relationship between the Native and Hmong cultures and the non-Native and Hmong cultures in the state of Wisconsin. How integrated are they? How much do we understand about these cultures, why they're here, how their cultures may be unique in some ways and similar to each other in some ways? Here's our phone number if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org if you'd like to use that. And you can also send messages on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Tomorrow we will, you know, today's election day, and we've been on these issues for such a long time. So after listening to a lot of radio and watching a lot of television tonight, we'll be up and at 'em tomorrow morning, and we will have a number of guests with us. At 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dolan, professor of politics at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, will be with us. And also we'll talk with reporters covering the Boston Globe's Matt Visor covering the Obama campaign, and no, Matt Visor covering the Romney campaign, and we'll have somebody from the Boston Globe covering the Obama campaign. At 10 o'clock, we will have reporters from swing states, and we will also talk with Chuck Wormbach and former WPR reporter who now works for Ohio Public Broadcasting, Brian Bull. So it will be a full day, and we'll all want to talk tomorrow. We want to talk all the time. Actually, that's why we're here. But we'll want to talk tomorrow about what we've done today. So that's tomorrow from 9 to 11. And rest assured, Joy will have complete election coverage. Ben will as well. So it'll be a full day of analysis. To your phone calls in a moment, our guests this hour are Matthew Stewart, chair of the Widening the Circle Symposium, and Song Seong, who's executive director for the La Crosse Area Hmong Mutual Assistance Association. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for our guests, and let's start with Bill in Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Hello. Very interesting, important topic. I'm wondering what models your two participants have for integrating American Indian studies, information, treaty rights, and Hmong cultural issues, and well, apply to both sides, I guess, into the curriculum. Many other immigrant or minority groups in American history have gone the route of, you know, yeshiva schools on Saturday or Greek schools for language and culture, and I was wondering if they've thought about or looked at some of those kinds of alternatives as well.
Matthew, you want to start?
Yeah, that's a Bill, thank you for your question. It's a great question. I think we have to go back to what we were talking about before the break to really get at the nature of the question, and that's that idea of marginalization that Song was talking about, that our school system since the time of the boarding schools and Henry Ford's big push for public education to get workers on his factory lines have really been about standardizing people and have really been about assimilating non-WASP people into American society and not necessarily making the old adage about the boarding schools is to kill the Indian and save the man. And it wasn't necessarily to make Indians into white people, but to make Native people to fit them into the kind of capitalist corporate, new kind of corporate model. And unfortunately, I think that we're doing the same thing in education so much today with our standardization, the neoliberal policies on education that we have to really make education not about, like Song had said, about critical thinking, about critical theory, but really to be about how do we get people to fit into the workforce. And So we start to look at that, and we look at the experience that other groups of people have had with schooling in the United States, and we really recognize that oftentimes those communities, even when they didn't necessarily want to assimilate as individuals, there was still a high degree of need to assimilate or desire to assimilate, to become American. And in a lot of ways, ideas of multiculturalism and certainly kind of old ideas like the melting pot are not something that most Native communities and Hmong communities want. Native Hmong communities and individuals really, I think, want to live in a pluralistic society in which Native and Hmong cultures and identity and languages can be not just preserved, but revitalized and really promoted. And so how do you do that becomes a really difficult question when the goals of schooling are still based on something very, very different from that, are still based on capitalist model of how do we get workers into into the workforce. And I realize that as a trained teacher, most teachers don't go into teaching to do that. And most teachers don't recognize themselves as cultural agents either. Our teachers, but we are. That's very much what we are. Part of our job is to teach a specific culture and to familiarize our students with it and to really assimilate them towards that, as well as to standardize our students. And this is very much a follow-through from the boarding school era. Sure, today we don't, you know, necessarily beat students or, you know, do all the horrible things that happened during the boarding schools, but we do continue to marginalize people whose cultures are different than white mainstream culture in our schools. And so it's very, very difficult to answer the question that Bill brought up without, you know, wanting to do something like jumping to building another school, doing a charter school or a private school that focuses on those issues. But like Song had said earlier, oftentimes those schools still promote the same culture, the same idea of what schooling and education is for in those schools, but maybe have an hour-long, you know, pull-out to work on Hmong language, or the school that Song was referring to specifically in the Twin Cities literally had their Hmong language and culture class in the basement of the school. And so it was essentially just a segregated school in which Hmong students went to, but the culture of the school was still that of any other school. And we see that same problem happening across charter schools, that ethnically based charter schools across, you know, Minnesota and Wisconsin. And so how do you do that? I think the first thing that folks need to do, and I think this is an excellent place where communities can join with Hmong communities, which in some cities across Wisconsin have a higher population, but is to join together and is to really stand up and say, you know what, we pay tax dollars here. These are our schools too. And we will have the things that we find to be important taught in our schools. And that includes language and culture, but not just as a pullout, not just as a separate, this is still a marginal thing, but as integral to the functioning, to the working of the schools. You know, we need to see that these communities, that elders from these communities are brought into the schools, that the goals and the and the missions and the perspectives of Native and Hmong communities are part of the functioning of the school. And we need to do that not just because it's important to Native and Hmong kids, but because having that diverse perspective, having that critical lens on I guess what we'd say white American culture, is absolutely an essential part of education for all students to really have. It's not just enough to say, well, it's important to learn that, you know, there's 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin, or that Hmong people came from Laos to the United States after fighting for the U.S. in the Vietnam War. It's also essential for us to understand and to get new perspectives on the world and to really begin to learn how to be more critical about not just the world around us, but of ourselves as well. And that's one thing that I think our education system has not been very good at. As somebody who's been teaching in teacher education, that's not something that we've been very good at in teacher education, is teaching teachers or future teachers how to be critical of their own privilege and their own bias. And these are the exact kind of things that we need to do. And these are the exact kind of things that perspectives, Native, Hmong, and Indigenous perspectives in general can offer on education, on the culture of our schools, and on kind of the nature of American society in general. And
thanks, Bill, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can also leave messages for us on our Facebook page. Song, let me talk to you for a moment about oral traditions. I know that you're speaking at the conference on the Hmong oral tradition, and I know there's a Native oral tradition as well, which it seems to me could be incorporated in general curriculum for all students. How important is that tradition, and how do you see that tradition finding its way to all classrooms, really?
Oral tradition is the basis of Hmong culture and who we are as a people. Our language is who we are. It's who Hmong people are, and you know, it's especially for people that never had a writing system. And throughout our history, we use that. We use oral traditions to pass down our religion, our culture, our history, who we are as a people, and how we came to be. And so it's a direct conflict with writing. Because now everybody has to learn how to read and write. And, you know, it wasn't until in the 1950s until there was a written language developed for the Hmong language. And so, you know, a lot of our elders, like I would say 90% of our elders don't read and write. So they're still really, their whole world is still this world of, I mean, the whole perspective is still the Hmong oral perspective on things. And then you have children that are grown up in this country that, you know, read and write, and they, you know, they need a sign to tell them to turn right and to stop. And so, you know, they're very heavily focused on writing. And so how do you get the two to talk to each other? There's a lot of conflicts, you know, with our young kids and our elders, because the two perspectives on the world are so completely different
and contrary to one another. Do you think the elders should learn to read and write?
I think they want to, but for a lot of them, it doesn't have any meaning to their lives. Mm. It doesn't. It's like if you've never seen the color purple, how would you describe the color purple to somebody? You know, mm-hmm. It's kind of like that, and so. Yeah, I don't think it makes any difference in them. And you know, my whole thesis was basically, you know, taking a stand on saying, look, our elders have, you know, 5,000 years of history in their heads, and we're never going to learn about it because we think that it has to be written down in order for it to be important and that it has to be validated. And so my whole thesis was basically challenging that whole aspect of you really have to know how to read and write in order to be considered a brilliant, intelligent individual.
Mm, that's fascinating. Let's go to Janine in Milwaukee. Hi, Janine.
Hi. Actually, I'm about a few minutes away from working with some elderly Laotian and Hmong people, and I have been working with teaching them really, really simple reading, and been getting quite a bit of joy from it. Very simple verb, object sentences. Today we're going to talk about election and president, and I support meaning with lots of visuals and realia, and they can read in the context of those pictures, and they self-select to come. They're involved in a senior program here, supported the local community-based organization. I also teach at MHEC, and we have about 70 different language people who speak 70 different languages. And I do feel that that it's important to respect all the cultures of that make the city such a wonderful, diverse place. And we do need to help the metro area understand the diversity that does exist here. One of the things that is apparent to me in listening to this conversation, as much as we would like to promote all these language speakers indigenous languages in the classroom. The fact of the matter is that books don't exist in these in many academic subjects, at least on the area level where a student can read and analyze and think critically. So it's because it just doesn't exist. There isn't a market to produce, let's say, a physics textbook written in Hmong or in a Native American language. So it's important for our student body to learn English really, really well so that they can think in abstract ways and think critically in English. I teach not only people who are learning how to read, but people who are already are thinking critically in their first language and now are transferring into wanting to read in English because many of the books in their own language don't publish at a higher academic level. And I'm talking about even Western languages. There are many people who are at the professional level who speak, let's say, Portuguese or even Spanish and who want to learn English better because they want to be able to read academic journals in English.
Right.
The fact of the matter is that English is the language of the business world today. And if we are going to do our student service as far as succeeding in today's global economy, they need to learn English. And English not only at a very basic level, but at a level where abstract ideas can be expressed and communicated well. I applaud you for this conference that you're having. I have to honestly say, though, that I agree with the Hmong woman who spoke earlier about doing students a disservice by not exposing them to, by marginalizing Hmong in the sense that it is a side subject. On the other hand, the reality is that to advance in any academic field, English has to be, at least in this mm-hmm. society, English has to be learned and learned well.
Janine, thank you very much. You were the perfect listener to this hour. Song Xiong, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, you know, and you're right, you know, being an academic and stuff, I don't understand where you're getting at, but I think what I'm coming from is that when you say that you have to know how to read and write in English very well in order to communicate in the scholarly world or in the academic world, what about the, you know, and I always go back, you know, one of the elders that I interviewed for my project or my thesis, you know, he said, you know, if I could write down everything that I know about, you know, all the things I've learned in my whole life orally from our elders that have been passed on for thousands of years, a library would not be able to fill the amount of books that I could write for you. You know, and I think that it really captures it in so many ways about the importance of oral traditions and how when we live in such a monolingual world and how we don't value the knowledge and the cultures of thousands of tribal people and indigenous people around the world. And one of the things I always tell kids, or one of the stories I always tell kids is during the tsunami, you know, thousands of people died. And these indigenous people off the coast of India, I mean, people thought that they were completely just, I mean, they were gone because, you know, they were considered Stone Age, backwards living, and all this stuff. And so when the scientists went in, you know, everybody on this island was fine. And they were, I think they lost like a dog or something, but everybody was okay. And the scientists were like, you know, what happened? I mean, you know, with our modern technology and everything, and we weren't able to save these people. We weren't able to predict the tsunami. And they were like, well, we knew from our ancestors and through the knowledge of our ancestors that when these signs happen, that we have to go up into the mountains and stuff. And, you know, we follow these steps, and that's how we were mm-hmm. alive. And so I think that when we say that, you know, yes, I agree. You know, we have to learn how to read and write English because it's the business language of the world and all this stuff. But I think when we don't acknowledge that other traditions and other mm-hmm. cultures, the amount of knowledge that they have to contribute to our world, I think it does a lot of, it really hurts the learning process of our children.
Mm, that's a very interesting response. Thank you, Janine, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. November 8th through November 11th, La Crosse hosting the 9th annual Widening the Circle Native American and Hmong Indigenous Education Symposium. It will address education in both the Native and Hmong cultures in Wisconsin. And this hour, our guests are Song Seong, who's executive director for the La Crosse Area Hmong Mutual Assistance Association. Matthew Stewart is chair of the Widening the Circle Symposium. More phone calls momentarily at 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this election day, if you have questions about where to vote, voter registration information, if you'd like the latest election news, or perhaps you'd like a little more information about the candidates, the biographies, interviews with the candidates before you vote, you can go to this valuable resource, WisconsinVote.org, and get all of that information, which you may need today. And then tonight, for election coverage, we start at 6 o'clock with an hour-long national call-in program hosted by WNYC's Brian Lehrer. At 7 o'clock, an NPR special hosted by Robert Siegel and Melissa Block. It will include analysis from NPR Washington editor Ron Elving, national political correspondent Mara Liasson, and political junkie Ken Rudin. At 8, a full evening of election coverage from WPR News and NPR News. State and national races will be covered. You will hear that at 8 o'clock, and it will go however long it takes. Starting on the Ideas Network at 6, starting at 7, programs will be carried on all Wisconsin Public Radio broadcast stations and streams. Back to phone calls for our guests. Let's go to Wendy in Hawkins next. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. I just want to comment. When I was growing up, you know, it was cowboys and Indians. I'm 55, and we were all considered savages. I'm part Ojibwe Indian, Chippewa. And it wasn't even real Indians that played this. It was Italians. And just 3 weeks ago, I was at a bar restaurant in Kenan, Wisconsin, called Happy Days. And I was eating, and this guy came in there, and I will not swear on the air, but there were tacos. There was like Indian taco, which had nothing to do with Native Americans, but he was dumb enough not to realize that, you know. And anyway, he says, oh, I think I'll have an effing Indian taco and be an effing lazy Indian, go to the reservation. I couldn't even eat my food. I went outside and everybody was laughing at me. And she came out, she threw the food on the porch, and I was so humiliated. And I'm just so sick of it. And I get it all the time. You don't go to effing Indianist men. And nobody will do anything about it. The police won't do nothing, nothing. And they said it's called freedom of speech. And I think it's just really ridiculous. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Yeah, you shouldn't have to live that way, Wendy.
I know I shouldn't, but
no.
I'm tired of it.
Matthew.
Wendy, thanks for calling in. this is a large part of why we started the work that we started, this is a large reason why Act 31 exists in the first place. I'm glad we have a chance to get back to this. The Act 31 and the racial violence that was going on towards Native people, especially in the northern part of the state, but really throughout Wisconsin, was not an anomaly. It was something that was being promoted by anti-Indian groups. It was even being promoted by Tommy Thompson as the governor at the time. He was famous for speaking at anti-Indian rallies. Groups such as PAR and other groups across northern Wisconsin that were actively advocating racial violence in the state, that were actively advocating for the abrogation of treaties. And because of that, because of the long history that Native people have with not just oppression but with racism, there is there's this historic trauma that has built up. And every time that these little microaggressions, that over time these little microaggressions become almost unbearable and really serve to affect people's lives. This is actually one of the things that we're talking about at Widening the Circle this year is, Wendy, if you're at all available, this might be really great for you to come to. But we have a an entire day-long workshop just on historic trauma and intergenerational healing to really talk about how the effects of historic oppression, how genocide, how racism really begins to wear down people, and how that often becomes part of the culture that's passed on, just to help kids survive. I think that's one of the things that we see still today. The reason I joked at the beginning of the hour about whether or not Act 31 still is in place is that it's meant to specifically address the lack of knowledge about Native people in the state. But we still have lots and lots of issues just like this that are popping up all over. For many years, I worked on the Indian mascot and logo issue in the state, and that becomes a really difficult issue. And we still see schools across Wisconsin that are actively teaching stereotyping of Native people. And some of the worst forms of racism against Native people in the state are carried out not necessarily by schools that have Indian mascots, but by schools that are playing schools with Indian mascots and logos. Mm-hmm. And we've seen some absolutely horrific things that are done. But aside from that, we are, and even when people say, you know, but this image is a positive mascot, it's still stereotype. And those are the kind of things that are difficult, even with a state mandate, to begin to change, unless we begin to really talk about the nature of our education system and how do we start to create space, not just to bring in other cultures and other perspectives into the classroom and into the culture of the school, but how do we create space for all students to be more critical about the education system that we've created in the society that we have.
And people need to speak up if you hear any of that kind of language being used. It can't go unnoticed or unchallenged. Wendy, thanks for the call. He knew in Neillsville. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for having the show. I've got a couple of questions. I'll just run through them quickly. First of all, is there an evaluation tool available in order to assess if our local schools are complying with Act 31 respectfully and sufficiently? If not, is there a way that parents, tribes, communities can go about evaluating this? Also, as far as advanced placement students, you know, I have a son who's in advanced placement, but he was denied the first time around because he scored well on his assessments and had high scores, but they weren't the exact in the exact order they would prefer to see. And one of the things that kept him out initially was because he was a bit of a silly boy. He was in fifth grade going into sixth, and he was a bit silly and kind of a class clown, which was frowned upon in our culture. We value humor, and so he was kind of, he's humorous, and that was held against him. And so the standardized education that's being talked about, it in a way doesn't value our people and our attributes, and in fact can be used against us. And what they wanted for him was to be more of a leader and less of a class clown. Well, he was from fifth grade going into sixth, and that would seem a perfect place in advanced placement to turn him and give him the traits to be a better leader and less of a class clown, or use that humor as a way of mm-hmm. teaching his peers.
I don't want to cut you short, but we only have about 35 seconds left. Matthew?
Yeah, thanks. I think for specific questions about evaluation tools, you can contact David O'Connor. He's the American Indian Studies Consultant at Department of Public Instruction. He's also involved in the conference. He'll be here. He's actually holding a time in which people can just come and just talk to him about these questions. And the phenomenon that he knew that you're talking about with regards to culture and the school really not recognizing that is an epidemic in across the United States for Native folks. In fact, there's a huge problem with wild racial disparities in placement of Native students in special education. Native students are placed in special education because teachers have a lot of stereotypes about those students because they don't understand a lot of cultural issues.
November 8th, we have to leave at this point. November 8th, thank you, Matthew, for being with us. Through the 11th, La Crosse is holding the 9th annual Widening the Circle Native American and Hmong Indigenous Education Symposium. We thank Matthew, chair of that symposium, and Song Seong, executive director for the La Crosse Area Hmong Mutual Assistance Association. A reminder, it's Election Day. Our coverage starting at 6 o'clock tonight here on the Ideas Network. Another reminder, if you need information about candidates, finding your polling place, voter registration information, a very good website. It is WisconsinVote.org, WisconsinVote.org. We will be with you tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Kathleen Dolan, professor of politics at UWM, and we will also be speaking with many other guests tomorrow. We'll have reporters covering the Obama campaign and the Romney campaign at 10 o'clock. We will talk with reporters from swing states and from Wisconsin. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this program.